From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, behind-the-scenes stories from two of NPR's best-known journalists, Nina Totenberg and Cokie Roberts. Legal correspondent Nina Totenberg will talk about breaking the Anita Hill story. And Cokie Roberts, one of the foremost experts on Congress, will tell us about how she was practically raised in the halls of Congress. Her father was House Majority Leader Hale Boggs. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Clinton sent Congress a package of new spending cuts today, cuts that he says will save up to $30 billion over 5 years. NPR's Mara Liasson has details.
At the end of the debate over the president's economic package, Mr. Clinton promised Congress he'd have more spending cuts in the fall. Now, as part of his initiative to streamline government, the president is offering a series of new cuts. Some, like the elimination of federal subsidies for wool and mohair, have already been made by Congress. Other savings would come from changing the way government buys goods and services. This procurement reform, the White House estimates, would save about $22 billion over 5 years, although the White House expects the Congressional Budget Office to estimate a lower savings amount. About $10 billion of the savings would go to deficit reduction. Another $5 billion or so would help fund the president's crime initiative, which envisions putting 50,000 more police officers on the streets. When the bill is introduced in Congress this week, a group of conservative, Democratic, and Republican lawmakers are expected to ask for even bigger spending cuts. At the White House, I'm Mara Liasson.
President Clinton said today that although he's accepted changes in his health care reforms, he draws the line at reducing the overall scope of the plan. The revised plan is to be presented to Congress tomorrow, but the new estimates of its cost savings are far lower than initially projected. The latest estimate shows the plan could reduce the deficit by around $60 billion by the turn of the century, down from forecasts of $91 billion in the original plan. Many streets in Mogadishu were deserted today as sporadic clan fighting continued. Elders appealed to their subclans to end the rivalry, and by late afternoon, most of the conflict appeared to be over. NPR's Michael Scholar reports from Mogadishu.
The flare-up that began yesterday after a peace rally may have left as many as 17 people dead and more than 120 wounded. The fighting seems, at its core, to have been a test of strength within General Idid's clan, with some groups trying to challenge Idid's faction. Elders of the various subclans stepped in to calm the violence, while UN troops stayed out of the way, even when fired upon. Many Somalis expect more clan power plays in the coming months as U.S. troops withdraw and the UN backs away even further from military involvement. That will leave a power vacuum here and force leaders of the different subclans and sub-subclans to reconsider their alliances. Sources here say U.S. Special Envoy Robert Oakley will return to Somalia very soon. This is Michael Scholar in Mogadishu.
Stock prices closed slightly lower today on Wall Street, partly in response to a report that consumer confidence took an unexpected fall in October. The Dow Jones Industrials lost about a point to close at 3,672. This is NPR. President Clinton said today that he doesn't believe that Canada's newly elected Liberal government will have an impact on the North American Free Trade Agreement. The Liberals won a solid majority in Canada's parliament yesterday on a platform that included dissatisfaction with NAFTA. The Prime Minister-elect, Jean Chrétien, has also said he wants to renegotiate parts of the Free Trade Agreement with the United States that went into effect 4 years ago. President Clinton said he called Chrétien to offer his congratulations today on the victory, but that the two leaders didn't discuss NAFTA. Workers at Air France are growing increasingly defiant. Their two-week-old walkout, which now includes pilots and airport workers, is snarling air traffic at two different airports. NPR's Lynn Terry reports from Paris.
Thousands of workers marched around the Charles de Gaulle Airport and the one at Orly, which are being guarded by riot police. Air France ground and maintenance staff have been on strike since earlier this month. They were joined by the company's cabin crews and pilots, workers at France's domestic carrier, Air Inter, and the Paris Airport Authority. The unions want the strike to continue until the government gives written guarantees that it will follow through on its promise to revoke a controversial restructuring plan. The workers also want strike pay and promises that no protester will be sanctioned. The government says it will come up with a new austerity plan that will not include any layoffs. The new head of Air France, who was appointed yesterday, will start negotiating with union leaders on Wednesday. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Terry in Paris.
Police in Cairo say that three Western tourists were killed and four other people were injured this evening when an unidentified gunman opened fire in a Cairo hotel. Police say the gunman was arrested. Islamic fundamentalists have been stepping up their attacks on foreign tourists in an effort to cripple Egypt's tourist industry. This is NPR News.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Occasionally on Fresh Air, we invite people on whose work you regularly hear on NPR and ask them to share some behind-the-scenes stories. We're devoting a couple of programs to that this week. Nina Totenberg is NPR's legal correspondent. Two stories helped make her a household name. She broke the story that Supreme Court nominee Douglas Ginsburg had smoked marijuana. That revelation effectively killed his nomination. And she broke the Anita Hill story. Let's start with an excerpt of Totenberg's report, which included the very first press interview in which Anita Hill accused Clarence Thomas of sexual harassment. This report was filed October 6, 1991, on All Things Considered.
This morning, NPR reported that Anita Hill, a tenured law professor at the University of Oklahoma, told the Senate Judiciary Committee and later the FBI that she'd been sexually harassed by Clarence Thomas when she worked as his personal assistant in the early 1980s. She said that when she worked for Thomas at the Education Department and later the EEOC, he constantly pressured her to go out with him socially, and that he would call her into his office to discuss work and turn the discussion to his, quote, sexual interests. According to Hill's sworn affidavit, a copy of which was obtained by NPR, Thomas, quote, spoke about acts that he'd seen in pornographic films involving such things as women having sex with animals and films involving group sex or rape scenes. He talked about pornographic materials depicting individuals with large penises and breasts, close quote. Hill said that despite her attempts to forestall this behavior, it continued. She said she told only one person about what was happening to her, a friend from law school. The friend, now a state judge in the West, corroborated Hill's story in part, both in an interview with the FBI and with NPR. She said that Hill had told her at the time of the alleged harassment in general, though not in detail. Hill, in an interview with NPR, said she had initially intended to keep quiet about her experiences, fearing retaliation and not wanting to relive the experience. But in early September, she changed her mind.
Here is a person who is in charge of protecting rights of women and other groups in the workplace. And he is using his position of power for personal gain, for one thing. And he did it in a very just ugly and intimidating way. But he's also really in spirit, and I believe in action too, violating the laws that he's there to enforce.
Now, you didn't go with the story as soon as you got Anita Hill's affidavit. I think you went with the story about 5 days later. What did you feel you needed in addition to the affidavit before actually filing the report?
Well, when you're dealing with very serious charges, at least in my view, when you're dealing with very serious charges about a nominee for high office, I am much more comfortable finding out that there is at least some basis for believing those charges to be true. That doesn't mean you know they're true. It means that there is credible evidence to support those charges. Now, an individual named Anita Hill had made this allegation but had not come forward. And I talked to her for many days about whether she would give me an interview about these charges. And it seemed to me that if I was going to air this story, I needed a witness for the prosecution, as it were, and that if the witness was not willing to stand by her charges, the charges were not worthy of airing. And so a good deal of what I did went to both persuading Anita Hill to at least consider coming forward, to verifying some of the charges as much as one humanly could, and in pursuit of that, I found one of her so-called corroborative witnesses, that is, a woman who said she told her about these allegations at the time that the alleged harassment occurred. And I spent a lot of time checking out Anita Hill herself to make sure she wasn't a kook or a crook and didn't have a well-known vendetta against Clarence Thomas. People who have vendettas sometimes say true things, but at least when you are going to put forward their charges, you better say that that person has a long-time vendetta. In Anita Hill's case, I found no history of a vendetta. She was a well-regarded, highly regarded professional. I spoke to most of her employers who spoke highly of her. And so I at least assured myself about her general character, her general reliability. And eventually, when she realized that I had the affidavit, she finally agreed to an interview.
Now, a reporter from Newsday, Timothy Phelps, published the accusations of sexual harassment the night before you went with the story. He didn't have an interview with Anita Hill, and he didn't have the affidavit. But how did you feel about another reporter going with the sexual harassment charges right before you did?
Well, first of all, it was in the Sunday paper. It wasn't really the night before. It was written the night before, as my story was written the night before. And
right.
I certainly could have put a short version of our story on the air because I already had the interview with Anita Hill in the can, as we say. And we gave some consideration to doing that, to putting it in our hourly newscast. But it was really our feeling that this was such a serious story and that we had so much more in detail than he did. And in fact, Newsday initially put his story on the inside of the paper because what he had was the fact that she had made a charge of sexual harassment, but no details. And it was our judgment, and I have to tell you in all candor, if I had to do it over again, I might do it differently, but it was our judgment at the time that we had just so much more of a story and that it was such a serious story that it needed the details to go with it, and that what we were waiting for was I had been unable to find Senator Biden, the chairman of the Judiciary Committee. We'd originally planned to do our story on Saturday night on All Things Considered, which would have been many hours before the Newsday story was even written. But we waited. We decided to wait one more news cycle because we couldn't find Senator Biden, and there were very serious charges in this story by her, and in fact by Senator Simon in some ways, about Biden not acting aggressively about these charges and letting them lie dormant for a matter of many weeks. So I felt that we couldn't air the story, and my boss agreed with me until we at least gave it one more news cycle's worth of time to try to find Biden.
But you said in retrospect you might have done things differently. What might you have done differently?
Well, we could have done a very short news spot, 60 seconds long, saying that there were these allegations and running a shortcut of Anita Hill. And we could have done that without ever mentioning Biden, I mm-hmm. suppose.
Mm-hmm.
And then we would have, in the traditional news sense of the word, not had to share credit with anybody because we had so much more. But you know, you make those decisions and then you just live with them.
Nina Totenberg is my guest. Now, you were ordered to bring your notes and tapes to the Senate for a special investigation of who leaked the affidavit. You faced contempt of Congress charges and jail for not revealing your source. What did you think were the big issues at stake in your refusing to divulge your source?
Well, it seemed to me obvious that there was no crime that had occurred here. The worst that had occurred was that the United States Senate had been enormously embarrassed by its failure to investigate serious allegations of wrongdoing against a nominee for the United States Supreme Court. And that the minute we talk about embarrassment, putting a reporter in jail because she got information that embarrassed a political body, we're talking about the very core of what we are as a democracy. that we wouldn't tolerate that in the Russians, much less in ourselves. And I like to think that we have a higher standard than the Russians do at this time in the formation of their infant democracy.
When you cover the Supreme Court now and you run into Clarence Thomas, what is the vibe like between the two of you?
Well, first of all, I don't run into him
very much. Right.
I see him on the bench. He sits just above where I sit in the Supreme Court. Now that there's a new member of the court, his seat is no longer on the opposite side of the courtroom. It is right next to the press section, sitting above us, a position that I must say makes him look extremely uncomfortable at times. But I've only talked to him once since his confirmation hearings, and that was the press by tradition gives a party for every new justice. And we did that for Justice Thomas as well, and he came, and he was very nice and very social, and when he walked in the door, I was the second person standing there, and we shook hands, and we chatted amicably, and you would not have known that I had done anything to make his life very miserable.
Do you feel that you know who is telling the truth, Clarence Thomas or Anita Hill?
I don't know for sure at all. I mean, I don't think anybody can know for sure. You may think you know, but you can't be 100% sure.
Have you tried to give your opinion even though you're not 100% sure, or do you think that's inappropriate?
I think that's inappropriate.
Why?
Because this was a story that happened because, to some extent, because of my coverage. And I sought to cover it as fairly as I knew how. And I would not want to, in the aftermath, go around proselytizing for either side. And that's what we're talking about, because mm-hmm. we're talking about sides here.
I think because you're so well known for investigating Supreme Court nominees, several people, I think, have tried to investigate you and have even floated rumors about your personal life. And I wonder if that's had any impact on your feelings about investigating others as a reporter and how you handle those investigations and revelations.
Well, it's probably always a good experience for a reporter to be written about occasionally, to know how unfair it can seem and what little control the subject of the article has. So it's not a bad experience, although you may not like the end product or you may think you're treated unfairly. And sometimes you are.
Sometimes you are treated unfairly?
Sometimes you are treated unfairly. I mean, I don't think I treat people unfairly, but Clarence Thomas probably thinks I treated him unfairly. Maybe Anita Hill thinks I treated her unfairly.
Do you worry about that a lot, what they think?
It concerns me from time to time. To say that I worry about it a lot is not true. But I think it's something that we ought to be concerned about. We ought to try our best to be fair, to give everybody an even shake.
Now, Nina, I can't remember if this was you or not, though I think it was. I remember once listening to All Things Considered and hearing, I believe it was you, say, in the middle of an intro, I can't read this. That was you, right?
That was me. One of my great moments of non-professionalism.
What happened?
Well, first, the background. When I don't do anchoring of All Things Considered anymore because they now have three hosts, but there were several years where I was the regular Friday host and the regular substitute and was on as a co-host of All Things Considered very regularly, all the time. And they had tried to get me to do this for a while, and I had hesitated because I really don't see very well. And I was afraid that I would screw up on the air reading live. And so finally they persuaded me to try it, and of course it was okay. But I remained nervous about my reading deficiencies. One day, they rushed an introduction for a piece into the studio to me about 10 seconds before we were to go on the air. And Robert Krolwich was doing his piece live from New York, or it was a live, what we call tape roll from New York. And what had happened was that the editor had taken down the introduction on the telephone, typing it. This is pre-computer. And his hands had moved on the keyboard about midway through the introduction. So that as you read down live on the air, you went from real words to gibberish. And I had no idea what this story was about. The editor is standing behind me in the studio, sort of jumping up and down, trying to tell me what these words are, but I can't read it. Now, if I'd been a really seasoned pro at that point, doing All Things Considered, I would have realized that and said, well, we have a technical problem. Why don't we go directly to our story in New York? Here's Robert Krulwich. But I wasn't a seasoned pro, and I was furious at being handed this introduction so late and then having it gibberish. And I figured, I'm not going to take the rap for this. So I said, live on the air, I can't read this. Robert Siegel, who was then the news director, called me to his office afterwards for a little discussion. And I think he was really going to woodshed me until I handed him the intro. And when he saw it, he just started to laugh.
It's one of those great moments of radio where something goes terribly wrong on the air. Were you embarrassed or what?
You know, I was so mad I wasn't embarrassed.
Nina, thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Nina Totenberg is NPR's legal correspondent. This is Fresh Air. Today we're hearing from two journalists who represent the level of excellence you've come to expect from NPR News. You probably have certain expectations of Fresh Air, too. Perhaps you expect to meet people whose work you admire and get introduced to new ideas or pick up suggestions of new books to read or records to listen to. We do our best to fulfill your high expectations. There's something we've come to expect from you, and that is that you'll understand and respond to our need for your financial support. Your station couldn't afford to bring you Fresh Air without your support. In fact, your station couldn't afford to do much of anything without your support. Please call with a pledge. Thank you very much. You might notice a couple of slight format changes this week on Fresh Air. The reason is many stations are taking a couple of program breaks to fundraise. For those of you hearing the show uninterrupted, we have a special series of music performances from our archives. We go back to 1987 for this performance by Marty Gross, one of the musicians keeping alive the art of rhythm guitar. Gross's father, by the way, was the German cartoonist and satirist George Gross. Here's one of the tunes Marty Gross played when he was getting started professionally around Chicago.
Sugar, I call my baby my sugar. I'm mighty sweet on my sugar, and sugar's sweet on me. She's confectionery funny. She never asks for my money. All I can give her is honey that she can have any time. I'd make a million trips to her lips if I were a bee, because she's sweeter than any candy to me. She's granulated sugar. I never baby my sugar. I always baby my sugar. That sugar baby of mine. Thank you. I'd make a million trips to her lips if I were a bee, because she's sweeter than any candy to me. She's granulated sugar. I never baby my sugar. I always baby my sugar, that sugar baby of mine, that ever-loving sugar baby of mine, of mine.
That was the first song that I think I ever sang in public, aside from the things you sing in grade school or kindergarten, but the first song I ever sang by myself. I was working in a saloon in Chicago, and I used to sit around the back room and play things and hum them to myself and for anybody else that would listen. And one day the leader said, "Hey, don't do it back here. Get up there and do it. Get out there and do it. We need all the help we can get." And nervously and tremulously, I went to the microphone, and that was the song I remember. And it was a particular favorite in Chicago, I guess because it had been recorded several times by a lot of well-known Chicago jazz players of the 20s and 30s and 40s. And so people would request it. And that number launched my tawdry, meretricious career on its way. This next song, after I was in Chicago for a while, I came back to New York where I'd started out. And on my first recording date, in 1950, which had such luminaries as Pops Foster, the famous New Orleans bass player, was on it, Dick Wellstead, a marvelous piano player, and others. First record date, we did this song called "I Would Do Anything for You."
I would swim the ocean wide, I would cross the great divide, I would do anything for you. Dun, 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 dun. I would take a trip to Mars, I would even count the stars, I would do anything for you. I'd gladly pay a fortune just to see you smile, hear you say I love you every little while. In my heart there's ecstasy, long as you have faith in me, I would do anything for you. Yeah. I would cross the great divide, I would do anything for you. I would take a trip to Mars, I would even count the stars, I would do anything for you. I'd gladly pay a fortune just to see you smile with your teeth in, hear you say I love you, you dog, every little while. Oh, in my heart there's ecstasy, long as you can faith in me, baby, I would do anything for you, for you. I'd do anything for you. Down, 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 down.
Rhythm guitarist Marty Gross recorded in 1987. His latest record features his quartet, the Orphan Newsboys, live at the L.A. Classic on the Jazzology label. This is Fresh Air.
Ba-da-da, ba-dee-dee-dee-dee, da-da-da-da. Ba-do-do-do, ba-dee-dee-dee-dee, da-da-da-da-da.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Cokie Roberts is a political analyst for NPR and ABC TV. She's a congressional expert who nearly grew up in Congress. Her father was Congressman Hale Boggs. Coming up, Roberts tells us about growing up in a political family and about her father's disappearance in a plane crash 20 years ago. That's coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Clinton has turned aside speculation that a change of governments in Canada will mean changes in the North American Free Trade Agreement. However, supporters of NAFTA on Capitol Hill say it's likely that the new government in Canada will insist on side agreements because of positions taken by Jean Chrétien during the campaign when he found portions of the agreement not acceptable. Chrétien won Canada's national election by one of the largest margins in that nation's history. Now, as Prime Minister-elect, he is putting together the team that will take over Kim Campbell's Conservative government. John Halber reports from Toronto.
This morning, Canadian newspapers were calling it a red tide, in reference to the use of red as the traditional color for the Liberal Party. With the exception of Quebec and two provinces in Western Canada, the rest of the country voted overwhelmingly for Jean Chrétien, Canada's 20th Prime Minister. Prime Minister Kim Campbell acknowledged her defeat, and already the Conservative Party is thinking of choosing a new leader. This is the first time since Canada became a country in 1867 that the Conservatives will not enjoy official party status in Parliament. The third traditional party of Canada, the New Democrats, also lost official party status as both they and the Conservatives made way for the separatist Bloc Québécois and the new right-wing Reform Party from the West. For National Public Radio, this is John Halber in Toronto.
Former President Jimmy Carter says that he's not planning to get involved as yet in the efforts to restore ousted Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide. Ed Hula reports from Atlanta.
Despite an appeal for Jimmy Carter's help from the top UN envoy involved in the Haiti negotiations, Mr. Carter says he prefers to let the UN-led efforts run their course. But Carter says if Aristide's return to power seems nearer, he would be willing to lead a team of current and former heads of state to travel to Haiti.
If it becomes necessary for us to do so, we would certainly consider sending a group of these very distinguished and experienced government leaders to try to help cement an agreement once it is consummated.
Carter says he has been keeping regular contact with Aristide and leaders of the military government. Carter was an observer for the 1991 elections in Haiti that brought Aristide to power. For National Public Radio, I'm Ed Hula in Atlanta.
In Cairo, police say a gunman opened fire in a hotel coffee shop, killing three people. Police say among those killed were an American and a Frenchman, and four other people were wounded. Police say the attack occurred at the Semiramis Intercontinental Hotel in the center of Cairo. A suspect has been arrested. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down more than 1 point to close at 3,672.49 on volume of 285 million shares. This is NPR News. The Pentagon has announced that the Clinton administration will go to the U.S. Supreme Court in an effort to get a court order to allow a new policy on gays in the military to go into effect while appeals are underway. Under the new policy, recruits will not be asked their sexual orientation, but those who are openly gay will not be allowed to serve. A federal judge in Los Angeles has ruled that a military ban against homosexuals is not constitutional. The Court of Appeals has turned down a government bid to delay this lower court ruling while appeals are underway. In Burundi, a week-old military coup appears to be unraveling as army generals ask the Central African nation's prime minister to emerge from hiding and take charge. NPR's Suni Khalid reports.
Prime Minister Sylvie Kanigi moved back to take power a week after Burundi's democratically elected president was killed in a military coup. With the backing of disenchanted army generals, Kanigi announced an end to the night curfew in the capital of Bujumbura as loyalist soldiers apparently secured strategic buildings. Kanigi, 40, had taken refuge in the French embassy in Bujumbura after mutinous troops last week killed President Melchior Ndadaye. The coup leaders were apparently led by former military ruler Jean-Baptiste Bagaza, who, like Kanigi, is a member of the minority Tutsi ethnic group that has long ruled Burundi. Ndadaye, a Hutu, was elected president in June. Meanwhile, ethnic violence was reported in Burundi's countryside, where Hutus and Tutsi were involved in massacres. An estimated 300,000 people have reportedly fled Burundi since the coup. I'm Suni Khalid in Washington.
And in Europe, the European Commission has announced a loss of more than 434,000 jobs in the last 5 years in textiles and clothing. According to a new study, this occurred because of automation, higher imports, and movement of production to other nations. Study found that more than 2,000 companies in the European community closed last year. This is NPR News in Washington.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is Fresh Air. It wouldn't be an exaggeration to say Cokie Roberts has politics in her blood. She covered Congress for NPR for 13 years and is now a political analyst for NPR and ABC TV. Her father, Hale Boggs, served in Congress for 32 years and became House Majority Leader. Her mother took over his seat after his 1972 death in a plane crash. I spoke with Cokie Roberts last spring before an audience at the WHYY Forum Theater in Philadelphia. I wanted to know if growing up in a political family influenced her attitude toward journalists. She told me there's a famous story in her family from 1952 when her father ran for governor of Louisiana and came in third in a bitter, nasty campaign. Cokie was 7 years old.
The counting had gone on all night long, and the phone rang the morning after the election. And my sister, who was 12, answered the phone. And the person on the other end asked to speak to my father, and she said, "He's asleep and he's been up all night, and I will not awaken him." And the guy on the other end says, "Well, what does he think about the election?" And Barbara says, "Well, he knows he lost." And but then she at 12 had the sense to say, "You know, who is this anyway?" And he said that he was a reporter for the afternoon paper. And she said, "Look, I'm only 12 years old. You can't use a word I said to you." And that afternoon's paper came out with the headline, "Source close to Hale Boggs concedes election." So.
Oh, no.
Oh, yes. And that is a, and that kind of thing happens much more often than any of us would like to believe. And it's a very useful thing. I gave a graduation speech at Columbia Journalism School a few years ago, and I started with "First, do no harm." And I think that it is a very useful thing to have been on the other side.
Do you think that you're more thoughtful of the privacy of politicians because of the situation you grew up in?
I do think I am more concerned about their privacy, but I also just see them much more as human beings, you know, as people with all the flaws and foibles and families of a human being, and that brings with it the respect that I have for human beings, but also the humor that I have about us all.
When I was growing up, my father was a millinery, and I had a sketchy idea of what he did, but I didn't really know for sure. When you were growing up,
you and Margaret Truman.
When you were growing up, your father was in Congress. How much of an idea did you have?
Oh, I knew
what
exactly
he really
what he was
did.
Doing. No, I knew. My father first ran for Congress before I was born, and Barbara was 15 months, and Tommy was born the week after he was elected. He was defeated 2 years later, went into the Navy, and then was reelected in 1946 when I was three, when I was two, really, when he was reelected. And so all of my life, he was in politics, and we were incredibly involved. My mother and he had had gone to college together. He had been editor of the college paper. She had been women's editor. And they had formed, with a group of other young people, a political reform group in Louisiana. Think of it. And it was to oust the successors of Huey Long. It was a very terrifying period. It was really a Hitlerian dictatorship, and they were engaged in a cause, and that was how they came into politics. When my father first ran, he was 25, and I think about it now, you know, from my perspective of age, and I'm thinking of my mother going to Washington at age 24 with these two babies. Think of it. Before World War II, when Washington was still a very formal city with a great deal of protocol. I mean, I've always admired her greatly, but now when I realize what her life was like, I admire her even more. But they were very determined that we would be involved in their political lives, that we would have no family life otherwise. And so we went on every campaign trip. We gave speeches from the tiniest of ages. It's no accident that all three of us have ended up doing something in the talking realm for a living.
Well, stop right here. Do you remember any of the speeches that you had to give?
No, I don't, but I do remember. I'm sure they would vote for Hale Boggs, you know.
Vote for my dad.
But, make Louisiana better, something, you know, keep the Mississippi River here, whatever. But that was very much part of our lives, and we went to Congress all the time. We went to school half year each place, so it was, I mean, our lives were the rhythm of the congressional season. And if there was an important bill up, we skipped school and went and watched the legislation. My mother felt, you know, arithmetic would always be there. We might not learn it, but it would always be there. And, I very much knew what he was doing.
Did you have to ever be the exemplary daughter
always,
on the campaign trail?
Always the exemplary daughter. I suppose it's only worse than being the minister's child. But as a Catholic, this wasn't an issue. I have. It's interesting because that's given me both sympathy for and yet a sort of a toughness about political families. Because on the one hand, I do understand what they're going through. On the other hand, sort of my reaction is, well, so shape up and do it, you know.
What did you have to do to be exemplary?
It's what you couldn't do.
What couldn't you do? What couldn't you do that everybody else was doing?
You couldn't go to bars as you got older. You couldn't be in a position where you were cutting up and people would find out. I mean, you had to be much better behaved in public than our friends were being. I mean, we're talking, keep in mind, New Orleans, Louisiana, you know. This is not a city that is known for its Puritan ethic. Unlike your own, and we were always aware that people knew who we were and that we did have to behave. And then, as we got older, there were all of the civil rights battles going on, and we were on one side, and the rest of the city was on the other, the rest of the white city, and that became very difficult. It became something where people would say hurtful things, and you would want to fight back, and you would fight back to some degree, but you had to be careful exactly how far you fought.
But you were usually on the same side of political issues that your parents were.
Until the Vietnam War.
And then what happened?
Well, we did the same thing every other young family, you know. Yeah, all of the youth of America was on one side and all of the older people on another for a long time, and then it changed.
Because your father had the power to vote and was also very influential, probably to even the president.
Sure, of course. He was a leader in the House of Representatives.
So did you try to change his mind?
Sure.
Did you think there's no way you were going to ever do that, so why?
Oh, no. We always argued. But we always did from day one. I mean, it was a household where that was valued. It was not discouraged.
My guest is Cokie Roberts, political analyst for NPR and ABC TV. Your father disappeared in a plane crash on a campaign tour through Alaska in 1972. I know he was never found. Was the plane ever found?
No. It's really remarkable. It was at the end of a congressional session, and the people who were there, I learned different things about it all the time still from people. He was exhausted, you know, at the end of a congressional session, you always are. You haven't been to bed for days, and he was majority leader, so he'd been, you know, running the House. And a young congressman from Alaska, a freshman, had begged him to come and campaign for him, and he desperately didn't want to go, I'm told, at the end. That, you know, it's such a long trip, and then the campaigning is difficult, and it always involves moving around in little planes, which he never liked. But off he went because he had promised to do it, and there he did. The plane never left from Anchorage, never arrived in Juneau. And the most extensive search in American history was launched, and not only by the good folk of Alaska, who were quite remarkable, but then, of course, the military was all called in, and then the spy planes all came in. We're very good spies, by the way. It makes me feel better about your tax dollars. The planes from 80,000 feet took incredibly detailed pictures, which literally rewrote the map of Alaska, found inlets that they had never seen before, all kinds of things. And when they would sense, there were also, you could take some infrared pictures, that kind of thing, and when they would sense something that they couldn't tell what it was, and send a helicopter down to see what the heat object was, it would often just be a log. Or they did find some World War II wrecks, that kind of thing. So I've got to believe the plane went to the bottom of the sea. I mean, that's the most likely explanation. It's also the most comforting.
Was there a moment where you and the rest of your family decided from here on in we will just assume that he has passed?
No. No. First of all, I think my mother felt that that would be letting down the search and the searchers and him. Secondly, the necessities of politics, he had to be elected. He disappeared on October 16th, and Election Day wasn't until November. So he was elected. And then as grown children, became more and more desirous of some sort of ceremony to end it. My mother, first of all, was very reluctant to ever give up. But secondly, again, the congressional necessities became the operative thing. So Congress convened in January, and his seat was declared vacant. And at that point, we then had a big memorial service in New Orleans. So,
one more question. I think, you know, from the outside looking in at your life, you seem to be somebody who has everything in a way, you know, a wonderful family, a fantastic career. Everybody admires your work and so on. I think most people end up feeling that they've sacrificed so much to have what they have and that they have enough of one thing but not enough of something else. What do you feel that you've sacrificed? Do you feel that there's like an important ingredient that's been missing in your life? Or do you feel like you've really had a balance that you're very comfortable with?
I've had a much better balance than most women are able to achieve. And my message to young women always is that I think that the important thing to remember is you've got a long life ahead of you for most people. I mean, they'll be in the workforce for 50 years, and you don't have to do everything at once. I said no to lots of good jobs along the way because they were inappropriate for my family at that time. Mm-hmm. I feel strongly that you can say no to something, and that's not the last time someone will ever offer you that. The one thing you do run out of time on is the ability to have a family. Your children, and then once you have children, they're only going to be young for a certain number of years. Your parents are only going to be old for a certain number of years. You're only going to have sicknesses that you need to deal with and take care of for certain periods of time. Those are the things where you have to say, this is the priority now, because it's not going to be here ever again. And work will always be there, all too much. So I think that that the choices that I have made have almost entirely been family first. That's not to say that on any given day, of course, or week or month, that I haven't worked around the clock and barely seen everybody. But in big life choices, they have been family first. And I that's one of those situations where you just don't regret it. I suppose if I had to say what's missing is that I still feel that I don't have enough time to spend with friends or with people who I think need some special care at this special moment for whatever reason. But I sure try.
Cookie Roberts is a political analyst for NPR and ABC TV. Our interview was recorded at the WHYY Forum Theater in Philadelphia. This is Fresh Air. Every day on Fresh Air, I talk to people about how and why they do what they do. Let me do something a bit uncharacteristic and explain a little bit about what goes on behind the scenes at Fresh Air. As you probably know, we're produced at Philadelphia's NPR affiliate, WHYY. We get our show on the air with the help of funding from various corporations and endowments. But that doesn't cover all our costs. So each station that carries Fresh Air, like this station, pays a fee, and that fee goes toward our production budget. During this fundraiser, Fresh Air needs to generate enough listener support to enable your station to pay that fee. I hope that Fresh Air listeners like yourself will call now with a pledge. Thank you for being there. Good news for rock and roll fans. This week we're featuring a series of pieces on the history of rock and roll. The burning energy behind the successful Memphis rockabilly label Sun Records was a man named Sam Phillips. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward explores Phillips' early producing days and the pre-rockabilly Sun.
When people mention Sun Records, the immediate association is, yeah, the greatest rockabilly label of all time, the place where Elvis and Jerry Lee Lewis and Carl Perkins and many more got their start. But what most people don't realize is that Sam Phillips, the man who ran Sun and the studio where all those people recorded, would never have made it to 1954 to record Elvis if it hadn't been for all the blues he recorded there earlier. Phillips had started as a disc jockey at various Memphis stations, and it was there that he noticed something. The Negroes had no place to record in the South, he told an interviewer much later. They had to go up to Chicago or New York to get on record, and even the most successful of the local entertainers had a hard time doing that. Sam noticed that Saul and Jules Beharie, who owned the successful L.A. label Modern, were recording Memphis blues artists in garages. So he scraped together enough money to lease a small building at 706 Union Avenue for $150 a month, and soon he was making records for the Beharie brothers in a clean, modern studio.
Be careful what you're driving, man. That Cadillac may get away. You better be careful. Down standing the highway, man. Standing parked on the road. Down standing the highway, man. Parked on the road. You better watch out for the red light just before you go.
Local favorites like Chester Burnett, the Howlin' Wolf, made records that blacks all over the country bought, and soon Sam was sending tapes not only to Los Angeles, but to Chicago. He got burned one time too often, though, and finally decided that if anybody should be pressing up these great singers, he should be the one. So in 1952, he asked an old high school friend to design him a record label showing a rooster crowing at a rising sun, and Sun Records was born. The first record issued on the label was Blues in My Condition by Jackie Boy and Little Walter, and was supposedly so bad that after testing it out on Memphis radio, Sam withdrew it. But Easy, the song we started with, showed Walter Horton in better shape and sold pretty well. But soon, he had to withdraw another record.
You know what you said about me, don't you, woman? Well, you ain't nothing but a bearcat. Been scratching at my door. You ain't nothing but a bearcat. Been scratching at my door. You can purr, pretty kitty, but I ain't gonna rub you no more.
Rufus Thomas's Bearcat was a straight-ahead copy of Willie Mae Thornton's huge hit Hound Dog, and Sam pulled the song rather than face the lawsuit that got slapped on him. But there was plenty of talent around. Nobody needed to plagiarize anybody else. Sam tried next with Dr. Isaiah Ross, a rural-sounding harmonica player from Tunica, Mississippi. This was too countrified for black buyers outside the South, though, so Sam headed to Beale Street for his next star.
Train I ride, 16 coaches long. Train I ride, 16 coaches long.
Little Junior Parker was the fastest rising star in Memphis, a veteran of a number of blues bands, including Sonny Boy Williamson's and Howlin' Wolf's. And Son made him a star with Mystery Train and this classic.
You know, the other day, I was walking down the street. I met a friend of mine. And we decided we'd stop and get a little something to eat. When I got to him, I said, "Say, man, look here." He said, "Yeah, Junior, what's happening?" I told him, "Whoa! So good, we're gonna boogie till the break of day." I said, "Look at here." He said, "What is it?" "Well, the old folks boogie and the children too. Don't nobody boogie like me and you. We're gonna boogie."
Unfortunately, Parker became such a star that he soon signed with another label and went on to stardom elsewhere. By 1954, Sam may well have been disillusioned with blues singers and their inconstancy. He'd started out watching them make money for others, and then he'd raised a crop of his own, only to watch them wander off. Maybe hillbilly singers would be a better bet, he decided, and set about recording some of them. And yet, as he often told Marion Keisker, his secretary, if he could only find a white boy with the Negro sound and feel. Little did Sam know that he'd find him soon, and that one of the first things he'd want to record would be Junior Parker's old Sun Blues hit, Mystery Train.
Train I ride, 16 coaches long. Train I ride, 16 coaches long. Well, that long black train got my baby and gone.
Ed Ward currently lives and works in Germany. Many of the old blues recordings Ed played in his piece can be heard on two rounder collections, Cadillac Daddy and Sun Harmonica Classics. I'm Terry Gross.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, world-renowned beer expert Michael Jackson tells us how beer is brewed and what makes a beer great. And he'll rate some of the leading beers from around the world. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.